07.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome back to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name is Nick Paul.
I am Simon Carnell.
And this is the Macau Sessions number 2. Thanks for everybody who turned into the first one. Once again, this is a very specific set of, not even interviews, just a conversation about performing in Asia.
It's extremely niche. Magicians in Macau.
I hope it's fascinating for someone who's not a magician who's going to perform in Macau.
Yeah.
Something a little bit more.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, for me, I always, anything I enjoy, whether it's music or cinema or books or whatever, like I've always, my whole life, wanted to know more of the story behind it, behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, not everyone feels the same way. A lot of people don't give a shit about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, if there's a song I like, I'm curious about, you know, what was the inspiration for it? Where was it written? Who wrote it? What was it like recording it? What were some funny stories from the days of the production? You know, all that stuff I always find interesting, like the extra layers behind all of it. So
I've read so many biographies, yeah, just for that purpose of, okay, how did you get from A to B to C? Because
yeah.
Everybody just sees the final point.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting to me to learn about the journey. Mm. And I guess we're kind of documenting it's not so much the journey now as it is the experience of being at the destination.
Yeah. I mean, everything's a journey depending on, you know, if you just zoom out further on the scale,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is now the journey to the end of this contract and beyond, you know, the journey to any individual show not sucking, you know, it's like 1,000 little journeys.
Yeah. So we were talking before this week. This week I learned that when I pull a card out of my mouth and put it inside a Ziploc baggie and try to give it to a Chinese audience, they don't like that. They are freaked out about it. So me, being a sick, twisted person, I've learned to play up that moment and really just hold it and then drop the bag on them. And it's funny how in America, 80% of the time they'll take that with them as a souvenir. But after shows, I'll always see it just sitting in the seats, which is really funny to me.
Yeah.
What about you?
What's I mean, one of the things that's really been that struck me about this is just how many magicians are intensely delusional about the non-trivial percentage of the audience who can figure out basically how their stuff is done. I mean, there is no magic trick that amazes everybody, and there's no magic trick that amazes nobody. You know, even the dumbest trick, you know, someone's unobservant enough to be stunned by it. But unless you're doing, like, really, really, you know, I'm not going to mention methods, but, you know, say the kind of stuff that Ozzy Wind does, you know, for the magicians listening, like, that's going to fool 99.99% of people. But there will still be that 0.001% of people who can even kind of half guess or, like, guess enough of it they kind of have a general sense of what's going on. And that's just the most deceptive kind of magic there is, right? If you go back to the kind of magic most magicians do, you know, myself included, which is very deceptive, very strong, plays well, you know, really bulletproof stuff, you'll still get a solid 1% or 2% of the crowd who can basically work out, oh, yeah, you had an extra one in your hand, or, oh, yeah, the one in the box wasn't the same one, or, you know, whatever. They can kind of at least half guess the method. The difference is that for Western adult audiences, most people are polite and hence don't mention that out loud to you, which can be a trap because it means you never find out.
Yeah.
You know, I've always had an obsession about asking audiences, like really interviewing them, you know, individuals or groups, like among many other better questions, do you have any idea how any of the stuff was done? And this is the question that in magic you're taught never to ask. And you definitely shouldn't be asking it in a performance. But for me, I was always curious. I wanted to actually find out what was really happening in people's minds while they were watching it. And you learn that, yeah, a lot of people can get pretty close to the method when they guess. Surprisingly, you know, it's not a majority at all, but it's a non-trivial minority.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas in China, they will point that shit out to you in the middle of the show, to your face, in front of everybody. And the other thing in China, because there's just less of a concept of intellectual property, that's just not kind of a thing that is culturally valued over here for various reasons. You go back into, like, communism and Marxism and Maoism and all, you know, you go back through the cultural history of why. But basically, intellectual property isn't really much of a thing here. You there is a lot of magic exposure around the place. A lot of kids in a
Talking about this. Yeah, this is fascinating. Yeah. I didn't know this until you brought this up.
Well, like in the same way that like a lot of kids in the US or Australia or the UK will grow up and they'll have had a Svengali deck as a kid. Like a lot of people know what a Svengali deck is. And you see this all the time when you perform. People want to look at your deck and they flick through it. Or a lot of people know about stripper decks in the US. You see that, you know, Lehman will kind of grab the deck and feel along the edges, you know, because they know about that method because it's in every beginner magic kit that most kids have had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in China, amplify that to most magical methods. Like, most stuff is out there. It's very exposed, very easy to get hold of, particularly in the last kind of few years since sort of the Lu Chen, you know, triggered magic explosion. A lot of the methods are just out there on the media and published. So what you get now are kids who are much more magic savvy than the average Western audience, because they've just heard of this stuff, who don't understand that magic isn't necessarily just a competition of figure out the method. And again, a lot of magicians are at fault for that, for presenting it as a look, I'm cleverer than you challenge puzzle.
Yeah, and I mean, you compared this to how everybody kind of knows what a thumb tip is in the US. But I would say there's still, it's not as prevalent here, but there still is that culture in the U.S. of they feel that their job is only to figure it out or to maybe not verbally bust you, but internally bust them, and not see that it's, you know, an art form with, and you're trying to get to something else other than fool the audience.
Well, let's face it, magic usually isn't. Right,
it's true.
As performed by most magicians, it's usually, ha ha, look at my, you know, look at my thing. And that's the thing. And honestly, even if you're doing very beautiful, artistic, graceful, elegant magic at its best, you know, like I can personally totally relate to the intellectual challenge of figuring it out. Like that was, you know, I got into magic when I was 18. I can very clearly remember being a total layman, non-magician. And I 100% wanted to figure it out. You know, like, why wouldn't you? Like, why would you not want to learn something more about what you're watching?
Mm-hmm.
The difference is, you know, whether you approach it in a combative, mean-spirited way of, ha-ha, I busted you, versus, oh, wow, I think I know how that was done, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very much, China is all about, again, someone described it here as, a lot of comedy here is driven on the misfortune of others.
Yeah.
Very schadenfreude heavy. It's a very mean culture. It's very, like, take people down.
And I can feel that I added in a moment that I've been working on this week of purposely getting the card wrong and then getting it right. But it's so funny. Just, like, you get it wrong. And just in America, it'd be like, oh, no, you didn't get it. But here it's like, ha, you failed. You're an idiot.
Yep.
And then... But the cool part is the moment you actually... I mean, one day I'm not going to actually get the card the second time and I'm going to feel like a doofus. But
yeah, but you know,
standard. That second production is... It's almost stronger in many ways because they're like, oh, wow, you fooled us twice. Which is... It's a cool thing to work towards. But yeah, that was an adjustment of the audience just wanting to just, you know, if they had tomatoes, they would throw them, you know?
Yeah, and it's not like you don't get that in the West, but it's, you know, it's a shifted bell curve.
It's quieter, you know, depending on the amount of alcohol consumed. Yeah.
Well, it's also sort of more of a, you know, in the West there'll be sort of a subtle sneer versus like an outright, ha, 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 ha.
Which, I don't know.
White guy is dumb.
I almost prefer that now in some ways just because the subtle sneer, it's like, well, what are you reacting? What did that come from? Mm. That used to drive me nuts. When I used to work at Disney, that would happen all the time. And the weirdest moments, like I hadn't even done a switch or anything, and the audience would react in that way, and they would drive me nuts. Yeah. But you just kind of have to learn to, you know, not react to those type of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, magic has always suffered from being a profoundly heterogeneous art form in that everyone does it really differently and everyone watches it really differently. You know, I always compare it to, say, theater, right? You go to see a play. We know what plays are. We get that. You know, a bunch of actors are going to pretend to be people, and the audience is going to watch actors pretending to be... You know,
that's the synopsis for every...
pretending to be people.
But it's
actors
the truth.
Aren't people.
They aren't. I majored in theater. We aren't.
Which director was it called them? Sweaty meat puppets. That was his word for
actors.
That sounds
familiar. I don't know who that is,
though. That's someone famous. But yeah, we get what a play is. You're going to watch it and no one goes, oh, wait, those aren't really the people. Everyone understands the idea of theater. Magic doesn't have that at all. Some people want to go there to pretend to be it's real and go, you know, oh my God, whoa, I love magic, yay. Other people absolutely want to figure it out. You know, others, a few people think it's real. You know, the crazies, but you get them. We've all met them.
It happens more, you know, so with mentalism, I find.
Actually. Some people think you are trying to make them think it's real.
Yeah.
And so basically, and, you know, I could go on with those different ways people see it. So you get this incredibly fragmented audience experience that's all over the place.
Yeah.
Which is one of the biggest challenges with magic, is trying to make it kind of a cohesive, you know, experience for the crowd when people are watching it with such different intents, as opposed to, you go to a comedy show, you're going there to laugh. You know, you go to a circus show, you go there to be impressed. Go to a burlesque show, there to be titillated. You know, like, they're pretty clear, you know, primary focuses at least, whereas magic doesn't even have a primary focus for the entire audience.
I think it's getting there, but yeah, because there's so... It's a good thing that there's so many different styles out now.
It's getting there, like gender equality is getting there. Give it a few centuries at best, and something it might that, maybe get there. You know?
Yeah, the history... People, you know, history books 50, 100 years from now, like, it took this long for what?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's... I don't know. It's something I used to really get frustrated about, but now I just kind of accept.
Yeah.
People are going to walk in there. They think they're, no matter what, for whatever, even though it's been dead for 100 years, people still think you're going to produce a rabbit out of a hat.
Yeah.
And for the one guy that's doing that still, you know, it's like
anyone doing that. I think I've seen
Well, that's what I love about.
Oh, yeah.
Penn and Teller's version of, they talk about that. They're like, yeah, everybody knows this trick, yet we can't find anybody that does it.
Yeah.
So they came up with their own method, and Penn's like, it's actually incredibly hard to produce a rabbit from a
which
hat.
Is why it doesn't happen. It's just that's not a thing.
A live rabbit.
Yeah, rabbit from a dove pen, rabbit from a production box, sure, rabbit from wherever. But yeah, never from, here is an empty hat, boom, now there's a rabbit in it. It's not like I don't think anyone does it, but I've definitely never seen it done live.
Yeah.
You know, basically no one has.
And it's so funny, you know, so many people think shit comes out of your sleeves, and
that's basically never done.
And I'm not going to say anything, but up until recently, I hadn't known anybody that did anything out of their sleeves.
Yeah, sleeves are used in kind of, you know, less than a tenth of a percent of 1% of all magic. It's just such a. That's one of the things I always explain to people when talking about magic. If you know, if they're curious and going, so you know what, blah blah blah, any actual questions, is I always prefix it by now going, good rule of thumb. Is everything you would intuitively guess about magic is wrong.
Yeah. All,
everything. It's not about being fast, right? Fast hands, no. That is actually the worst thing you can do. Sleeves are basically never used. Magicians are actually very collaborative and share most of their secrets with each other all the time. You know, you just go on. Any guess, you know, an average person makes about magic is actually exactly the opposite of what it really is, almost always.
Yeah, because those have all been used in movies and, you know, stories to, you know, add a...
Yeah, dramatize it. Well, it's it's like the media portrayal of, you know, doctors and policemen.
Yeah.
You know, like, wildly, heinously inaccurate in nearly every way.
99% of them are just trying to do their job. Mm. They have difficult jobs. And, and we're not certainly comparing ourselves to doctors and policemen. We play with decks of cards for a living. But... that element of just public perception is there for sure. Anything you've learned this week in doing shows? We've had some interesting, you know, I was warned about the audiences and my first week was great. I had all good audiences and it was a holiday week and there were, most of the audience still have been good, even though it's slowed down a little bit because Chinese New Year is over now. But we've had a couple just random one-off audiences of no reactions or reactions at the weirdest spots. I had one lady just clapping constantly.
Yeah.
Stuff you can't, like, as an American performer, you know how to deal with a drunk, you know how to deal with a talkative audience. But this was, I was just so flabbergasted. I just had to power through my set because like, I don't know, I'm not trained enough yet
Who
to know how to
people?
Handle this.
What is their deal? Yeah.
So that's going to be, and that hasn't happened a lot, but I can see it's going to come out of nowhere like it has the past couple of days.
Yeah, the problem is for me is just when you get the completely disengaged audiences.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously so much the onus is always on us, the performer, to reach them. That's our job, is to bring them along and create the experience for them, but damn it if sometimes it just might seem impossible.
Mm-hmm.
To those sort of slack, disinterested faces. And you kind of wonder, why did they even buy a ticket to this?
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I keep trying to remind myself that that could easily have been me, you know, 20 years ago when I didn't know anything about performing arts. I didn't even understand that comedians maybe told the same jokes every show. You know, back when you know nothing about performing arts, have no background to it, no context for it. And if you're not necessarily a super extroverted person, maybe you just want to kind of sit there with an impassive face and watch the show.
Yeah.
You know, people don't necessarily buy a ticket to something on the assumption it's an interactive experience or on the assumption that anything is expected from them. So I keep kind of trying to remind myself that, no, it's not, you know, they don't owe us anything. You know, this
sort true,
of...
That's true, yeah. The fact that they showed up is enough. And, yeah, that... I had to learn how to be a good audience member, especially, like, in a comedy show.
Oh, yeah.
Because... if people aren't laughing or if people aren't, you know, getting on board with what's happening, it's a very awkward 45 minutes.
But that's also, again, it's absolutely can't be, the onus can't be on the audience to be a good audience member. You know, it has to be. Now, if you're a professional performer, then, yeah, you want to, you know, we watch shows very differently at that point.
But, yeah.
And that's one of the things that this gig, even with its extreme challenges, I'm already noticing has been good for me, is it's forced me to really work on my kind of audience warm-up engagement skills, like how to bring the reactions out of people, you know, if they're not offering them up on their own accord, which again, they're absolutely not obligated to.
Yeah, you were talking about eye contact, and I've been, you know, just purposely working on that over and over. If I can feel I'm losing them a little bit, I'll just go boom right to their eyes and see what that connection is. Well, and it helps.
Well, even like with that, something I've started doing is when, like, and this is actually something Franz talked about that he was dead right on, that was a really good piece of advice, was this idea of making sure that you're addressing comments to individuals throughout the show constantly, like whenever saying something. And so one thing I would do, for example, is have a card chosen as part of one of the routines I'm doing here and say, okay, did everybody see it? And I would look at people, you know, like looking around, making eye contact with people, going, did everyone see it? Looking for nods. But now I've started going... addressing individuals like, did you see it? Yeah, you know, yes, did you see it? Did you see it? And go to, say, two or three people and actually ask them individually, did you see
it? That pulls focus, different, because everybody will, voom, look at that guy, and then they'll look at that guy,
So now the audience is thinking about each other as well as thinking about me, so you've got a much stronger link between you and them and each other.
Yeah, that's a wild change. And, I just wrote a blog piece on... just comparing the movie Groundhog Day to what we're doing. We're essentially living the same moments over and over and over. But we have, I'm trying to look at it as like, you know, a gift, a superpower, because, oh, we know how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
Therefore, you can tweak the little moments in between, try to enhance them or, you know, not do things. I've stopped doing a couple little beats just to see how it makes the piece different. That's a great gift to have, because not...
Yeah.
You know, comedians are always, you know, I'll do the Comedy Magic Club, and they'll be going to, like, do two or three other shows that night. You know, 8 o'clock show, 10, go down to the Comedy Store, do a midnight show. It's like, holy crap. But they're just trying to get that flight time. Yeah. So we have the gift here, and a lot of times as magicians, of being able to do stuff over and over and over that a lot of performers don't have.
Yeah, this is, my schedule just got increased a couple of days ago.
Oh, yeah, it sucks for you.
It's good and bad in different ways. It's bad because it's exhausting. It's just like I'm doing nearly twice as many sets now. And this is, you know, within the contract and everything. But doing twice as many, I'm now doing the maximum number of sets, you know, that that was, you know, possibly listed as happening. I was on basically half before, which was much more relaxing. I mean, not even real. Even that was exhausting.
Sure.
Now it's just insane. But already, you know, now when working on a new bit, you know, grinding it in, say, just that first awkward dozen times to even figure out the basics of a bit, you know, now that happens, bam, in 2 days for me. So I'm really trying to use this opportunity to work on things I want to work on, to try them out and really test them in front of audiences.
And if you can get them to work here, you know,
they'll work anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no, because things I'm finding work here are being silly and goofy, you know, sort of thinking more in that clowning style, you know.
Yeah, I've had to play that up quite a bit.
Yeah, which can be quite fun. It's so tricky, though, because, again, there's, again, the intense kind of heterogeneity, if that's the word, of magic audiences, like lots of different kinds of audiences all in one audience. You know, it's not like they're all on the same page. You get the people who... you know, I've heard kids in Mandarin, you know, I will do, for example, my finger magic routine, which is, again, this is, I don't think, did we talk about this last time? I can't remember.
I don't know.
So in, one of the things I often do in a show is open it with the old removable thumb visual gag magic trick thing. And you do that in the West, and everyone knows it, you know, nearly everyone, you know, 98% of people.
Yeah, that's something that the kids kind of learn in elementary school.
Yeah, you know, and nearly everybody. Now, that's the other thing that, and this isn't just magic, this is magic, you know, sociology, politics, you know, gender studies, everything, like all of human interaction, there's no statement you can make that's always true. You know, everyone goes, now, everyone knows this. Now, that's not true. You know, at most, it's going to apply to like 99.9% of people, which leaves hundreds of millions of humans on Earth that doesn't apply to. Those people are still important, you know. So I'm going to say most people, the overwhelming majority,
sure,
know the old thumb thing. But a few will still freak out, right? So you got to be aware of both of those reactions, even though one's the tiny minority.
I'm going to preface by saying that your version, you know, you've added a couple layers to it that make it very strong. So it's not, not just doing this
the old
thing that everybody is. You've added your own spin on it.
Which I'm very proud of.
No, yeah, it's a great piece.
But it opens still with the basic thumb thing. And I do it and I build it up, you know, right, ready for a trick. And I do the well-known, the not terrible. Everyone thinks, oh, the terrible trick. No, it's just a well-known trick. Mm-hmm. That's a very good illusion. And as soon as I do it in the West, the overwhelming majority of the audience, they understand that I know that they know how it's done. And therefore, they understand that I'm doing it ironically as a self-effacing parody gag.
Sure.
And they get, and that's quite a few layers of cognition, right? To go, oh, he knows, we know that he knows that we know how it's done. Therefore, he knows that, oh, therefore, it's an ironic gag. Oh, that's quite funny. Okay, we like this guy. That's kind of the analysis it gets in the West. And that's why I like it as an opener. Whereas here, I started doing that in the first few days, and it would be a weird combination of way more people would freak out because they've never seen it. But then the people who already knew it just kind of went, this guy sucks. this guy's trying to fool us with that. You know, it was like one several layers of analysis lower.
Weird.
Like it was much more unsubtle analysis they were applying to it. So I really had to start to modify. I tried modifying the way I did it. And now the way I make it play in China is I do it, like remove the thumb. And then just as they are going, oh my God, this guy thinks this is fooling us. This guy sucks. I then move my hand to reveal the method. So it's kind of me. And then they realize that I'm acknowledging that they know the method.
Mm.
So it's a much less subtle sort of way it's being received. And so modifying the performance to make it that one level of subtlety lower, so it now connects again with the audience.
Yeah.
And it's a weird kind of cognitive, you know, dance trying to work out what level are they thinking on, and then how can you be just only one level above that but not two levels above that? Because it's like rock, paper, scissors. You know, if you bluff, you know, you can be one ahead of them. But then if you double bluff, now you're just doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's fascinating how you have to. You have to. That's the toughest thing for me is I'm worried that with the adjustments I have to make to routines I've done 1,000 times, I don't want to forget the American version.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I will. There's a video. I can always go back and look.
Yeah. But worst case, it'll take you a week or two to get back into that style.
Yeah.
You'll have an awkward first few performances as you readjust.
Yeah, I don't think it's... I'm not as worried as I was about it, you know, a week or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
But that was certainly my big concern.
It's also worth pointing out as well, like, I know that we're using a lot of words like, you know, like simpler and less subtle and dumber. Like, these aren't pejorative value judgments, right? This is just the different, you know, like, cultural level here. You know, mm-hmm. This is like, I'm sure, what a lot of other countries are like at various points in their kind of, you know, cultural evolution.
Yeah, because we're, the intelligence of the audience is... could be greater than most Americans, but it's just the fact that they've never experienced entertainment
The cultural environment you've existed in. You know.
The amount of people on their phones during the show. Like, I do a bit with a phone, and if somebody's on their phone, I'll always go to that phone, grab it, and use it. And my favorite part is the second I vanish the phone, it reappears, I give it back to them, they immediately go back to texting on their phone.
Yeah.
But they were just applauding and thrilled 2 seconds ago. It's just, it's not even a thought process of this is incredibly rude.
Yeah.
It's, oh, this is a show and I'm going to return this message right now.
It's amazing how, yeah, even just things like there's less sort of awareness of, like, and it's one of those things that, you know, like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, just concepts that just don't exist culturally, like this idea that intellectual property isn't really a thing in China that mm-hmm. is valued or even aware of. I'm trying to, like, imagine, I don't know, in the US, you know, things... You know, we don't have the sense that if you insult someone, you, like, that's a, you know, that's worthy of killing them in a duel.
Hmm.
You know, we just don't have that idea. That's ridiculous to us. In China, that's intellectual property. Why would you want to own an idea? What's the point of sure. that? You know, it's just not a thing. You know, it's, like, completely normal. And, like, also here, there's less of a sense of personal space. You know, you can just kind of grab people and shove them around, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, the concept of... The non-existent concept of lines is here. You know, if there's a space, somebody's going to fill it.
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, you don't queue up for things. Mm-hmm. You know, you just get in there with the elbows and get to the front. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... And it's also even weirder, again, in Macau, because, once again, you've got this weird mishmash of the mainland China and Hong Kong and the local Macanese... and the Taiwanese, and then the other people from Southeast Asia and the rest of the world. So it's this really complex mishmash of different cultures all in the one audience. You know, it's dominated by the mainland Chinese just because they're the biggest population group.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's plenty of much more sophisticated, you know, urbane Hong Kong people coming through as well who, you know, over, statistically, you know, shifted bell curves tend to make for the better crowds, you know, because... But that's only because they are arbitrarily more familiar with the Western, you know, quote-unquote Western styles of performance and entertainment.
Yeah, Hong Kong you know? Has so many Western-style theme parks yeah. and science centers, all these, like, yeah. things I was looking up yesterday. I'm like, oh, it's essentially oh, yeah. Chicago.
Yeah, Hong Kong's great. You know, yeah. Hong Kong's a really cool place.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going next week, and I'm, yeah. I thought it was going to be very similar to here. It seems like it's going to be very different.
Hong Kong's kick-ass.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's it is what it is.
Challenging and rewarding. And I think thinking about that thing of going once we get back to the West and start to, you know, readapt.
I just horse and buggy, cowboy hat. I was telling you this that, you know, on Netflix here, it's very limited because they don't have the rights to things.
Mm.
You can all watch all Netflix, you know, branded content, but there are subsection of Western comedies. And I'm like, oh, like Blazing Saddles. No, it's just Western comedies.
Yeah, like Friends, Two and a Half Men, Big Bang Theory.
You get
this
Friends
is, this
here.
Is the West. Yeah, and it's... I mean, it's amazing you just look at... You know, that universal human challenge that not enough people try to do is sit down and just kind of imagine the universe through someone else's eyes.
Hmm.
You know, say you grow up in Shenzhen... mainland China, you know, the West, you know, where white people live, that's a completely different universe. And the other thing is, again, the average, you know, statistically, the average person growing up in China compared to the average person growing up in the USA or Australia or the UK or Canada or, you know, the West, you know, number one, you have much less opportunity to potentially travel to these places. However, you've also got much greater level of default cultural exposure. You know, a lot more US films and TV shows get exported and watched in Asia than Asian shows end up getting watched in the US. You know, how much Asian, you know, media do we actually watch? You know, unless you're really into anime, you know, or explicitly seek out foreign movies because you're a hipster. You know, I don't mean that. I like a lot of foreign movies, mm-hmm. but that's the way it's often seen by people. You know, you don't really see much of that culture. You know, where it's, so it's just such a different cultural dynamic in so many ways. You know, the way that the East sees the West and vice versa, and then which parts of the West. You know, you look at Kentucky and then San Francisco.
Yeah,
universes apart, but way more similar to each other than, you know, Guangdong is to either of them in terms of China. You know, and same we look at China. You know, you see Shanghai versus Beijing versus Hong Kong
sure.
versus. You know, like some, you know, somewhere out in like Xinjiang or somewhere that's way more rural and
I don't even know where that is.
Yeah, like northwest, I think. My geography is pretty hazy. It's they have really good cuisine. So it's like a thing because when I studied in Beijing way back in 2001, it was like a Melbourne University summer semester optional study course. I mean, God, what an opportunity! Holy crap! You know, that's like an insane level of, you know, cultural privilege to have the chance of just, oh yeah, we'll go study in another country. And we were a bunch of maybe 25 of us from Melbourne University, you know, all basically Australian, you know, but like there were a lot of, you know, Australian-born Chinese. You know, Australia, Melbourne is a very big cultural melting pot. We were over there studying in Beijing at a university, and the university we were at was called the Central University for Cultural Minorities. And what that actually meant in China's context was cultural minorities from around China, like the different peoples of different parts of China coming to all study in Beijing.
Yeah.
You know, again, you look at the different cultures within the US, it's a similar thing, you know, from like Idaho or Kentucky or Massachusetts or like all these different places.
It's wild how you just naturally, at least for me, just naturally, China, okay, all the same people, but it's like America, no, there's so many from, you know, east to west coast, it's so diverse and different. I mean, just look at the freaking election, you know, like all the ways people voted that, you know, our neighbors, you know, voted differently from each other. And you see the world differently. So you can only imagine here of, you know, 1 billion people.
1.6, I think.
It's, there's, just the amount of little subsets of people. Yeah. And then they're coming to see us perform.
Yeah, going, like, who the hell are these freaks?
So of course it's going to be a different audience every, it's going to be a crapshoot every single time.
And it also makes sense, you know, why they sort of react or indeed don't react the way they do. Because they have, a lot of them just have no idea what the heck they're watching. You know, that's why you get those sort of impassive faces. They don't, they're like kind of withdrawn into themselves wondering, what is this? Who is this person? What is it, what are they doing? What are they, what the heck is going on? You know, it'd be like if you walked into, I don't know if you've ever seen a Beijing opera. I have, I think, once in Beijing when I was over there. And it's, to a Westerner, it's the most bizarre, freaky, weird thing. And it's entirely likely, I'm sure, I sat in that crowd going, just not reacting, going, what the fuck am I watching? You know, so to them, you know, it's the kind of reverse cultural version of that, just watching this bizarre thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. I don't know. I do feel fortunate that a lot of the times I'm the third act being seen, so I have two warm-ups ahead of me, so I have it a little bit easier. But, you know, the other night when we had that really weird audience, one of the other performers is like, top three worst audiences of all time. Yeah. And he had been here for months.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay, that's good. It wasn't just me. And for him to do that many shows and say that was the top three, that's a pretty good ratio of good audiences, you know, for what we're combating in terms of cultural difference.
Mm. Well, that's something I'm starting to find is working because, you know, now finding myself as the de facto warm-up act, you know, which is a role
I've... essentially are.
Yeah, I'm the first person they see and I'm the first magician they interact with. So it's like, it's on me. It's like, I got you guys. You know, I'm the point man.
Yeah.
And that's a role I've never really... I don't really have any experience with. I've, you know, always been a relatively low-key performer, for better or worse, you know. And whereas now I'm kind of having to, like, adapt very quickly to... And I'm finding things that work is just getting them... You know, and this is old news to a lot of comedians and performers and so on. But, you know, it's like, it's... I'm learning from scratch on things like just getting them, you know, all right, you know, if you want to see magic, say yes. And then, you know, just get things like that, really basic, simple, interactive stuff. And I'm doing that in Mandarin now, which is so weird for me. I thought I would be speaking little bits of Mandarin, but now I've had so many crowds come through, particularly the smaller crowds when, you know, we get smaller days, where basically almost no one speaks English. And I'm like, all right. My non-fluent, imperfect Mandarin is still the is still going to be better than their English.
Just in simplistic terms, the difference between Mandarin and Cantonese again, because a lot of people who speak Cantonese understand a little bit of Mandarin, correct?
So basically, I speak basically no Cantonese. So
Cantonese is spoken primarily in China, yes.
So Cantonese is spoken primarily in Hong Kong.
Oh, okay.
Mainland China is now officially Mandarin. Okay. So, rewind, you know, hundreds of years, many, many, many different dialects of Chinese, you know, effectively different languages. Kind of like, it's not really an analogy, English and Scottish, but like more different than that.
Sure.
You know, like, and so all the different dialects around, oh man, my history is sketchy here. At one point, one of the ruling groups of China decided, screw this. We are making this dialect the official main dialect of official China. And that was Mandarin. They decided, grab this dialect. This is the one now. And so that has now become the official language of mainland China. Hong Kong always spoke Cantonese. Taiwan also speaks Mandarin, given the complex history between those two land masses, not to get political. And but now even most people... who grow up, say, in rural, different parts of China, they still speak like Hakka or Hokkien or like various other dialects, but also get taught Mandarin in school. So they learn, you know, the official China as well as their local dialect language.
Huh.
And similarly now in Hong Kong, I believe most people are being taught Mandarin as well as Cantonese, because particularly now so many mainlanders are traveling to Hong Kong all the time, there's now so many Mandarin speakers there. That, and, you know, give it a few decades and you will see, I think, more and more Mandarin and less Cantonese everywhere where Chinese is spoken. But for now, Hong Kong, Cantonese is still a big language in... It's the official language of Macau and Hong Kong.
Yeah.
But most people still speak some Mandarin. Now, they are... My understanding is they are written the same. The written script is basically identical. But it's just a profoundly different pronunciation of all of the words. And there are a few little, like, linguistic differences and colloquial differences, but it's pretty much just the same language with completely different pronunciation and a few other little bits and pieces that I don't know enough about, you know. But basically, like, you can't understand each other. Like, a Mandarin speaker can't understand a Cantonese speaker.
Interesting.
Unless
okay.
you learn it. It'd be kind of like... If you know what you're looking for, you can hear the similarity. It'd be like if in English, you know, hello, how are you... in the Cantonese version of English, it'd be like hapu hei it ya. You can sort of hear that those were based on the same words, but if you didn't know that, you know, hapa meant hello and ya meant you wouldn't be able to guess that necessarily. Even though you can go, oh yeah, you and ya, you can see they're both like, you know, a Y and a vowel.
Yeah.
It's sort of that kind of thing, but there's different tonalities in Cantonese that, you know, there's more tone differences between the syllables. Mandarin has four tone differences. Cantonese, I think, has 7 or 9. Yeah.
I just remember when we got into a cab and you started speaking a little bit of Mandarin, and then the cab driver's like, do you speak Cantonese? And you're like, no. And there was just silence the whole 15-minute
car ride. Yeah, that's often the thing.
And I just assumed you could still understand each other. But, it's just such a vast difference.
Yeah. Well, it's also being, you know, and again, this is like my Mandarin, which, you know, goes back to high school. You know, thank you, Melbourne Grammar Mandarin Department, you know, and then Melbourne University Mandarin Department for the training that has still stayed with me. It's like my grammar and pronouncing. I mean, everyone's grammar in Mandarin is perfect because it's grammatically one of the most beautiful, simple, logical languages on earth. The pronunciation takes a while to get your mouth around. But where I fall down is my vocabulary is probably only about 300 words or so. You know, and that's increasing while I'm here. But I have a friend, shout out to Andrew Masters back in Melbourne, a good friend back from way back in high school. He also did Mandarin back at high school. And out of everyone I've ever seen, his vocabulary in Mandarin is probably about 40 words now. You know, he didn't keep it up at university. But more than anyone I've seen, whenever he meets a Mandarin speaker, he will jump, like, you know, headfirst into a conversation with them at the most basic, you know, he will get more usage out of his 50-word vocabulary than some people with 10 times the vocabulary, just because of the enthusiasm and, like, the willingness to make the interaction work. And that's actually something that's been a source of inspiration for me here, is even though my vocab is really limited, when doing shows... You know, that can still be really funny and engaging and leaning into the comedy potential of that, that, you know, I can still communicate enough and finding ways to do things with the words you have, mm-hmm. as opposed to going, I don't have that word. Okay, so I won't bother.
Yeah, and I think that's essentially what we're doing in a nutshell. It's just, here are the tools we have. Here's our tool belt. And just use what you can. And improvise when needed.
And then developing new tools as quickly as possible.
Yeah. We're in your apartment right now, and there's tools everywhere. You're just building things. This is amazing.
Yeah.
This looks exactly how Teller describes being a magician. I just want to say, you have boxes and little bottles and things everywhere, and you're trying to build new props and things. And
yeah. Well, this is me daily lamenting that I don't have access to my... You know, my Hollywood workshop, aka my apartment. It's basically a workshop that happens to have a bed and a bathroom, you know, where I live. And yeah, it's sort of challenging going, oh, I wish I could make this device, and knowing if I were back, you know, home in the US, I could make it in an afternoon. Whereas here, I've got to kind of like find the right tool or find something that I can substitute for it or do a makeshift something. So it's Yeah, constantly sort of thinking through, looking at the world through MacGyver's eyes.
You're like, essentially the Q from 007 of magic, just with all your little
props. I'll take that.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'd prefer to be the 007 from 007, but I'll take Q. That's maybe good.
It depends what day you are. Depends if you're having a nerdy day or a day where you're going to go get the girl and, you know, get out of an exploding car. But I think that should bring us to our conclusion for this week's episode of the Macau Session.
This is Macau Session number two.
Let's see. You can follow me in the Twitter at Nick Paul Magic. You are
Things by Simon on Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, everything.
Yeah, and I'm on the same thing. Facebook, Nick Paul Magic, and if you have any comments, questions, fan mail, or hate mail, you can write to twomagicians1mike@gmail.com. You can also find us on the Facebooks and Twitter, too, at Two Magicians. And, yeah, if you have any thoughts, please send us our way. We're just kind of verbally explaining our experiences here. I hope somebody gets something out of it.
Sharing behind the scenes.
Sharing behind the scenes.
For anyone, for whoever's interested in that. Which is, you know, a bunch of people.
Hey, we
some
viewing figures.
Some notes. Listening figures.
That's good. That's all that matters.
I'm doing more Instagramming these days.
That's good.
I'm trying to force myself to do the social medias.
Yeah, see what we were bashing last week. Yeah. Now you're
like, no, lead into it. Things by Simon. Now that I have a better haircut. I got my hair cut a few days ago. That was an achievement, trying to find a hairdresser in Macau.
Yeah, that would be my...
Who I could communicate with.
That'd be my adventure.
Luckily,
next week.
I befriended a local who was very helpful in navigating that.
It's little things like that, you know. It's the haircut. It's the getting the right type of soap. It's, you know, these are the little challenges.
The thousand tiny different things. I mean, that's true of traveling anywhere.
Yeah.
All right.
Awkward silence ending.
It's been real.
Go.
Lean out from the awkwardness. Still awesome.
All right. Bye-bye.